those of you who are visiting this morning, my name is Gary Albert, and we're going to get into our study on the life of Joseph. We've been in for a few weeks now, and we're going to continue on. If you don't mind, go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 40. We're going to be in 39 for a little bit, but then we'll get there. A guy by the name of Louis Grizzard writes for the Atlanta Constitution, or at least he did for a number of years. He's a comic writer who occasionally writes serious stuff. He's also written a couple of books, and they always have kind of interesting titles. One of my favorites is Elvis is Dead, and I Don't Feel Too Good Myself. And then another time he had major heart surgery, like open heart surgery, and he wrote a book about that experience. And he gave it a title that sounds as if it's kind of like out of a country, top 10 list, country music top 10 list. It was called, They Tore My Heart Out and Stomped That Sucker Flat. But the question is, have you ever felt anything like that? Ever feel like someone has just kind of, ripped your heart out and then just ground their heel, into that tender, pliant, flesh until you just couldn't take it anymore. You may even have felt a little bit like it was God who was doing the grinding. John Stott, in his book, The Cross of Christ, is writing about what was usually called the problem of pain or suffering. And he writes this, he says, the problem of suffering is far from being of concern only to philosophers. He says, it impinges upon nearly all of us personally. Few people go through life entirely unscathed. It may be a childhood deprivation resulting in lifelong emotional turmoil or a congenital disability of mind or body. Or suddenly, without warning, we are overtaken by a painful illness, redundancy at work, poverty or bereavement. Or again, perhaps we are afflicted by involuntary singleness, a broken love affair, an unhappy marriage, divorce, depression, or loneliness. Suffering comes in many unwelcome forms, and sometimes we not only ask God our agonized questions, why and why me, but even like Job, rage against him, accusing him of injustice and indifference. And he says, I know of no Christian leader who has been more forthright in confessing his anger than Joseph Parker, who was minister of a city temple from 1874 until his death in 1902. And in his autobiography, he says in his autobiography that up to the age of 68, he never had a religious doubt. And then his wife died. And his faith collapsed. In that dark hour, he wrote, I became almost an atheist. For God has set his foot upon my prayers and treated my petitions with contempt. If I had seen a dog in such agony as mine, I would have pitied and helped the dumb beast. And yet God spat upon me and cast me out as an offense, out into the waste wilderness and the night black and starless. But it's not just the death of someone we love that can cause that kind of depth of despair. You can't help but wonder if Joseph ever felt like that. Stop and think about it. We've just been in this study for a few weeks. Think of everything that Joseph has gone through so far in our study. It was like he received undeserved treatment by a family of envious brothers who threw him into a pit and then sold him as a slave. Later, he became an innocent victim of false accusations by Potiphar's wife, who screamed rape. And then finally, as we left him last week, he finds himself in circumstances of the worst possible kind, cast into the waste wilderness of the night, black and starless, in incarceration in an ancient world. Look at verses 19 and 20. Verses that we looked at last week, that'll kind of bring us into the next chapter. Remember what happened? Potiphar's wife made those accusations. And verse 19, now it came about when his master, that is Potiphar, heard the words of his wife, which he spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. And so Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in jail. Some scholars actually think that they have a fix on where this prison is. It's called the prison of Sarah, and it was like an outpost prison in a desert in between Egypt and Palestine. And in the next chapter, we get a little bit of detail. Turn over to chapter 40, look at verse 15, where Joseph is later relating the story. He says, "For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should have put me into the dungeon. And if, in the margin of my Bible, it says pit or hole. In the ancient world, they would often use dry cesspools as prison cells. They just replaced the toilet seat with a roof that was kind of shaped like an inverted bowl. And Joseph would have just been dropped or lowered into this pit, down into this dark, dank, stinking, windowless interior. Now, whatever the reality is, whether that was his particular experience, no ancient world prison, was a picnic. You might remember last week when Matt read us a description from F.B. Meyer, what an ancient world prison was actually like. And Joseph had to be thinking exactly what we would be thinking. Where is God in all of this? I mean, I can see God in the good things. I can see God even in the questions. But at the bottom of a cesspool, this is ridiculous. And when you're in the waste wilderness, black as night and starless, and one scream, God, where are you? Now, if you were with us last week, Matt showed us the answer to that question. And it's actually in verse 21 of chapter 39. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. Where was God? He was with Joseph. And by the way, if you happen to miss Matt's message last week where he developed this whole theme, of God with Joseph and with us, go back to the website, go to Facebook, and listen to that message. I promise you will not be disappointed. And if you are disappointed, I'll give you all your money back. This is a terrific message. I don't want to give away the ending, but everybody around me, the tears running down their cheeks. But God was with Joseph. And not only that, we just read, he extended kindness, and over time, Joseph was, again, promoted. As he had been in Potiphar's house, he was promoted to a position of responsibility. And Joseph saw the hand of God in that prison experience. And in that prison experience, God became real to him. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who spent, I think, over a decade in a Siberian gulag in a foreign labor camp, later wrote about the experience. Actually, I think he wrote it when he was in prison and they were to get it out some way. I think he memorized it. He said, "It was only when I lay there on the rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. And gradually it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts." And then he said this remarkable thing. He says, "So bless you, prison. So bless you, prison, for having been in my life." How could he say that? Because in prison, God became real. And it's amazing, to read the stories of like Alexander Solzhenitsyn or Corrie ten Boom and Brother Andrew or anything like a Chuck Swindoll, and see how God used that prison experience to reveal himself. Now, I'm not suggesting that you ought to commit a felony, in order to meet God. But the truth is, God can meet us in prison experiences. But it depends on remembering, as Solzhenitsyn also pointed out, that the meaning of earthly existence is not as we have grown used to thinking in prosperity, but in the development of the soul. Remember that passage again. The meaning of earthly existence is not as we have grown used to thinking in prosperity, when everything's going right, the wind is at your back, bluebirds, sunshine, daisies in the field. It's about the development of the soul. And it's not until we get that that God can do his work in us. Now look at verses 1 through 7 of chapter 40. It says, and then it came about after these things, Joseph being thrown into prison, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and so he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was in prison. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were confined for some time. And then the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt were confined in jail. They both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream, each dream with his own interpretation. And when Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. And he asked Pharaoh's officials, as the cupbearer and the baker, who were with him in confinement in his master's house, he said, why are your faces so sad today? So Joseph is in this stinking hellhole of a prison. He didn't deserve to be there. He had done nothing wrong to deserve this. In fact, he had done everything right. Nevertheless, I want you to notice at least a couple of things that helped him survive this horrific experience. And the first thing that I want you to notice is just his attitude. His attitude just kind of shines between the lines of every verse. And I notice it first in what's conspicuously absent. Notice that there's no hint of bitterness or resentment or anger or malice. There's no nursing of a grudge towards Mrs. Potiphar. There's no evidence of animosity or revenge of spirit. There's no writing on his cell wall that says, I don't get mad, I get even. He's not doing push-ups and chin-ups, just building himself up so that when he gets out, he can get back up. Get his revenge. And in fact, if we just read the text, you get the distinct impression that Joseph is trying to make the best of this terrible situation. He just seemed to have chose a positive, resilient attitude in order to get through this. Viktor Frankl was a Viennese psychiatrist. He survived the Nazi death camps in Auschwitz and Treblinka. And he discovered that the imprisoned person who no longer had a goal was unlikely to survive, and his work led him to the conclusion that what he titled Man's Search for Meaning was in fact the primary force of life. And this is what he said. He said, we who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. And they may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken away from a man, but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way. The way in which a man accepts his fate and all the suffering that it entails, the way in which he takes up his cross, kind of unusual language for was Jewish, gives him ample opportunity, even in the most difficult of circumstances, to add a deeper meaning to life. I mean, isn't that true? I mean, oftentimes we can't choose our circumstances, right? It throws us a lot of things. Things that we didn't choose. But we can always choose our attitude. Someone said, I suspect it's true. Life is 10% what happens to us and 90% of how we respond to it, our attitude. And Joseph's attitude shows up in his dealings with the two men in the cell block and for whom he becomes responsible. One is the king's cupbearer and the other is the king's baker or cook. And the cupbearer, some of you know this, his job was to taste the Pharaoh's food to see if it was poisoned. And if it was poisoned, so long cupbearer, long live the king. Years ago, I came across a man named Henry Bowden tells this story. He says, when President Jimmy Carter was awarded an honorary degree by Emory University in Atlanta, the luncheon followed the ceremonies. A fruit cup was served to the first lady, And before she could taste it, a Secret Service agent removed it and placed another in front of her, so he switches it, guarding against possible poisoning. And this guy says, I wondered if the agent might have it tested, but soon I discovered I was wrong. He simply placed the fruit cup in front of me. The cup bearer for the day. Now, a cup bearer often has a really close relationship with the one that he served, and that's going to become important a little bit later on in the story. But you have these two guys, and the other convict, is a baker. He's also in a responsible position. And these two guys, apparently they did something to upset the Pharaoh, and we're not told what it is. Because both of their jobs have to do with food, maybe it had to do with something with these meals or something like that. Maybe he believed that they tried to poison him in some way. Maybe one day they got a little bit lazy, and so instead of, actually fixing dinner, they went to El Toro in Tacoma and brought that in, and he got really sick, and he thought, these guys are trying to kill me. Got no virus or something. Well, whatever it is, we're not told. What we do know is that two men had these unusual dreams that caused them some distress and concern. We're also told, this is really important, that Joseph noticed that they were dejected. And that he asked about their sadness. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but whenever we're hurting or suffering in some way, we have a tendency to become very self-absorbed. When you're sick or whatever, it becomes all about, at least like for me, it becomes all about me, right? Taking care of me. And some of that can be helped as necessary, but in the extreme, when you're wallowing in self-pity and you're in danger of drowning, that's not very healthy. John Roper, in his terrific book, If You Want to Walk on Water, You Have to Get Out of the Boat. So he's talking about storms in life, but he actually uses Joseph as kind of his example, kind of an illustration of what he's talking about. And it's a little bit long, but I want to read it. It's really good. He says, in prison, Joseph initially found meaning in a very simple way by helping a couple of cellmates, a baker and a butler. And one morning, after they had troubling dreams, we're told that when Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. And so he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him under house arrest, why are your faces downcast today? Norberg says, this is a striking detail in the story. It would be easy for Joseph to become isolated, to focus only on his own disappointment. When life does not turn out the way you planned, you forget that other people face disappointment too. And you begin to think only about your own hurts. Your world becomes so small that your pain is the only pain you notice. This is the death of the heart, the loss of meaning. And instead, Joseph realized that he is not the only one for whom life has not turned out according to plan. And he lives the way Jesus would. He treats disgraced prisoners like human beings. He notices them. He asks about them. He expresses genuine interest in them. At a time when we would expect him to be self-preoccupied, Joseph is sincerely concerned for others' well-being. Why are your faces downcast today? He does this even though he is not expecting anything in return. By his noticing, Joseph gives meaning to his presence in prison. And he says, I wonder if part of the meaning of Joseph's suffering was to develop compassion. That is not to say that all human suffering is merely a moral object lesson from God. I think that kind of theology trivializes human tragedy and blasphemes God's character. But I wonder if Joseph didn't need to face a storm or two. Joseph was the golden boy. He wore the robe. But it can be a hard thing to wear the robe of favoritism and expectations. It damaged the brothers who were deprived. And yet I wonder if it damaged Joseph as well. When you are the golden child and expect to lead a charmed life, some bad things can happen. Then, across the page, paragraphs. He says, as long as he was wearing the robe, Joseph could never enter the community with his brothers. As long as he was wearing the robe, Joseph would never know what he was capable of under adversity. As long as he was wearing the robe, Joseph would never understand that God is enough when you have lost everything. In any event, whether it was deliberately sent or in order to teach Joseph something, or whether it was simply the result of living in a fallen world, the storm hit, and Joseph learned what life was like without his robe. When he was home, he never seemed to notice how his grandiose dreams and exalted status affected his brothers. But now, in prison, he noticed. His suffering gave him eyes of compassion. Translation: God was not only with Joseph, he was at work in his life. God was working in his life. And here's another example along the same lines. Look at verse 4 again. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of him, and then underline this, and he took care of him. He took care of him. The force of that detail is that he went beyond what was required. And so add to this idea of just a right attitude, a servant's heart in this. We've already touched on that a little bit. One writer said, even though he's bleeding, he's helping the wounded. He cared for them. In the margin of my Bible, it says he ministered to them. And you see that in what happens here. Look at verses 8 through 13. And then they said to him, we've had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it. And then Joseph said, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. And so the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine there were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. And now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and so I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup. And I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, and then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days, and within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. And so the cupbearer, he tells his dream to Joseph, and then Joseph tells him of the meaning. He says, in 3 days, good news, you're going to get your old job now. But then he says this, look at verses 14 and 15. He says, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you. He says, it's going to turn out good for you. But keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should have put me into the dungeon or into the pit. Just hang on to that for a minute, because we're going to come back to it. But just for now, notice the humanity of Joseph. Now, the cupbearer, he gets this, you know, this positive interpretation of his dream, this positive prediction. And so the baker now, he has courage to ask about his dream. Big mistake. Look at verses 16 and 19. Now, when the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, I also saw my dream, and behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And in the top basket, there were some of all sorts of baked food for the Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. Well, that must be good news. Not. And then Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days, and within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off. The baker said, that's the last time I tell you my story. Anybody else here know how to interpretation? Now, if I were Joseph, I would have been tempted, you know, kind of fudge the truth a little bit. You know, buddy, your dream's a little bit fuzzy here. I can't quite make out the picture. But I can tell you this. Don't buy any green bananas. Now, some read this and they kind of accuse Joseph of being kind of callous. And just read it in cold black and white, it kind of seems that way. But I think after all that Joseph had been through, I'm guessing that he said this with tears in his eyes. But it raises an important point. A servant's heart doesn't mean that you never have to say hard things. Having a servant's heart doesn't mean that you never have to say hard things. Sometimes that's the hardest part, most difficult part of ministry. You have to love people enough to tell them the truth. And sometimes it's hard. Look at verse 20 and 22. After 22. And thus it came about on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, Pastor's birthday, that he made a feast for all of his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. And he restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, and he hanged the chief baker just as Joseph had interpreted to him. In other words, everything happened just exactly as Joseph had predicted. The cupbearer's head was lifted up. The baker's head was lifted off his shoulders. One got his job back. The other did not. But while everything went just as predicted, it wasn't what Joseph wanted. Remember, look at verse 14 and then verse 23. Remember this? Remember, he told the cupbearer, when you're released, he said, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. But then there's verse 23. And yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Aren't you glad for verse 14? You can begin to think, you know, if Joseph normal, Joseph wanted just exactly what we wanted, the same part that beats in you, beat in Joseph, and he wanted out of that stinking hellhole, just like you wanted. And when the cupbearer was released, you can imagine his joy. I mean, this was good news. He was going to get out. He was going to make parole. He wasn't going to be in prison anymore. He wasn't going to be a slave. This was going to be a celebration. And then he waits for a day, and then another. And at first he tells himself, well, you know, it's just red tape, or, you know, the cupbearer is just waiting until the timing is right. You know, so, you know, make sure the king is in a good mood before he asks. And then days become weeks, and weeks become months. And then verse 23. And eventually it becomes obvious. He's been forgotten. And he's alone. And he doesn't even have his two friends there anymore. Which reminds me of a joke. You guys only gave me polite laughter at my other joke about the bananas. So I don't really want to tell you this joke. It is a good joke. It's a story about three guys who were on a shipwrecked on a deserted island. And they're there for a few years, and they find a bottle on the beach. And so they rub the bottle, and the genie comes out of the bottle. And the genie says, I'm going to grant you, you know, three wishes, one wish, you know, for each of you. And so the first guy says, what's your wish? He says, wow, I've been here so many years and stuff, I just want to get back to my family. And poof, he was gone. And then the second guy says, no, what's your wish? He says, oh, man, I've been in the sun, you know, hardly any trees on this island. I just want to go someplace where it's cool. I just want to go to the Alps, you know, see the snow. And so poof, he's gone. And then it came to the third guy, the genie said, well, what's your wish? He says, you know, I'm kind of alone here. I wish I had my two friends back. He also might feel a little bit like this. I've told this story before, but I can't remember how long it's been since I've told it to you. So if it was like the last month or so, forgive me. It's a story about when our daughter Bethany, she's now 26, I think, but when she was like 7 or 8, she was just a little girl, and I took her to the fair. And it was just, you know, me and her, 5 kids, and she's the youngest, and I was taking her to the fair. And, you know, not sure how long, she said, don't want to go to the fair with her dad and stuff. So we just had a great day. And at some point, though, she had to use the restroom. But it's just me and her. So, you know, we go over to the restroom, and okay, I mean, you just go in there, and I'll wait right here. And so she goes in, and a few minutes pass, and a few more minutes pass, and pretty soon it's getting kind of long. Now I'm starting to pay attention. I see, you know, women are going in, they're in there for a long time, and then they come back out, and I still don't see Bethany. She's not there. And you know, starting to get nervous. So are the security guards who are watching me standing out. And then suddenly, it occurs to me, there's two entrances to this bathroom. It's in a big building. There's one here, and there's one on the other side of the building. And Bethany, maybe she got turned around in there, and she went out, on the other side of the building. Now, what do I do if I leave here? She may come out to the big building. Finally, I just decide, I run all the way around the building, all the way around. And then I get there, and you can see people are kind of swirling around, and you see this little 8-year-old girl, and I came up to her, and you can see the tears were just starting to well up in her eyes. Of course, I scooped her up. It was a hug of her. Apologize profusely and hope that she's forgiven me. She listens to me. She's on the East Coast. She listens to the messages and everything. So I got that. Thought she was forgotten. Daddy, forgotten. Alone, that sad feeling that would be. And I want you to look at verse 1 of chapter 41. And now it happened at the end of 2 full years. That Pharaoh had a dream. 2 full years. It just takes a second to say those 3 words, but for Joseph, it's 730 days. Do you know how long that is in dungeon years? It's forever. Joseph had a right attitude. He developed a servant's heart and needed something else. Spirit. It's hard to hear, but according to James 1, that is the end purpose of trials. Consider it all joy, my brother, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, and the discipline of endurance comes by learning how to wait. One of the hardest things that God ever calls us to do. We're going to talk about that next week. But until then, remember this. I'm going to say, you may be forgotten by others, but you were never forgotten by God. You may be forgotten by others, but you were never forgotten by God. One commentator said, God had in mind for Joseph the long haul, not the short run. He was preparing his servant to be the prime minister of Egypt. And the kind of leader God wanted Joseph to be couldn't be hammered out in a few days. In the crucible of this prison experience, God was forging and shaping and tempering and polishing the character and the future of Joseph. Now, in a minute, we're going to have our time of response. We're going to sing a couple more songs. As always, we're going to share the Lord's Supper. And you're free to come forward and celebrate that with us. Or you're absolutely perfectly fine to just stay where you are. Sometimes you might have to move out of the way to put somebody out. Just usually come down these two side aisles and then grab a piece of bread and go down the center aisle. And then John and I will be available to pray. John will be back in that corner. I'll go back over in that corner. Really the heart of pastoral ministry is to go pray for folks. So we'd love to do that. But as the band comes up, I want to read another story about Louis Cazar. I've got to tell you about it from the beginning. Steve Brown is actually telling this story. He says, Louis Cazar one time was speaking at the Marriott Hotel, and he said that whenever he speaks at the Marriott, he always orders what they call the Marriott chicken. And he said, when you begin to examine it, you discover it's boneless chicken. And he said, he got to thinking one day, where in the world did they get this boneless chicken? And he said, he did some research, because he's a reporter, and he found out that they have a farm in Vermont where they grow boneless chickens. And he said, he went up to visit that farm in Vermont, and when he got there, it was a pitiful thing to see these chickens walking around without any bones. But then Steve Brown says this. As a matter of fact, Louis Cazar had the facts right. He was eating boneless chicken. But the interpretation was spurious. And he says you can do that with history or the events in your life. You can have the facts, but not necessarily the proper interpretation of the facts. And he said we can do that in a lot of areas of life, especially when we're experiencing trials or hardships or suffering or setbacks or losses. Whatever it is, those are the facts. But make sure you get the proper interpretation of the facts. And the proper interpretation of the facts is as follows. Nothing happens to me, nothing happens to you, that it doesn't first go through nail-scarred hands. There is a purpose, so be patient. God is making himself real to you in a way that you would never otherwise experience. My suffering has meaning when I understand that God can use that for good. Remember, that's where Joseph is going to end up eventually. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. So nothing happens to me except it first passes through a nail-scarred hand. Second, everything I endure can prepare me for serving others more effectively. The Lord can use my pain to help you be more compassionate, to learn how to be compassionate. He can use my hurt to help other people. Someone said, you who have endured the bitterest experiences are the choicest counselors God can use. When something terrible happens to you, who is it that you want to talk to? You can appreciate the prayers. You can appreciate the kind words of lots of people. But you want to talk to the person who's been there, who's been through it, and come out on the other side. See, God doesn't waste suffering. And we shouldn't either. There's an interesting verse, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, sorry, 1:4. The Lord comforts us in all of our affliction so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction. God comforts us so that we can turn around and comfort others. And so come to this table. So come and remember the Lord's death. There's one more thing that I want you to remember. It's a lesson that Corrie Ten Boom learned in her own prison experience. As a little girl, as a Christian, in action.